What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
3, 2, 1, and we are live with Kerry Cassidy, folks. Long overdue. Kerry is the co-founder of Project Camelot, which explores controversial claims and theories surrounding mind control, secret programs, UFOs, ET phenomena, hidden technology, and alleged government cover-ups. Oh, the government would never cover up anything now, would they? Kerry, huge thank you for spending this time with us. All of Kerry's links are in the description box, the YouTube channels, socials, everything. So please support her important work. Before we get into all those subjects, what got you into this in the first place?
Oh, God. Okay, so I've been doing this about 21 years, and initially, I was a researcher, you know, on my own, and I was trained in journalism in college. So then I went to work in Hollywood for 20 years and was ending up sort of reaching a glass ceiling with the entertainment industry. I didn't join the old boys network. I didn't have anyone trying to help me in my career go along, really. I had some people that spoke highly of me, but other than that, so at a certain point, I got into, you know, I saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind when I was a kid, and I knew about that, and I had been abducted. So I thought that when I walked out of the theater, everyone was going to be in the same headspace and understand that we had ET, you know, contact. And actually nothing changed when I was very young then in my teens. And so ever since then, I wanted to do what Spielberg does. I wanted to make blockbuster, you know, sci-fi movies. That didn't quite work out, but I did get into broadcasting, and we actually started the trend of I like to think, on YouTube and Google. I was a YouTube director very early on, 21 years ago, when they were first starting out. And so I had the ability to make one or 2 hour videos when everyone else had 10 minute segments. So that's when that's how I got started. I was abducted when I was a young kid. I knew a lot that I didn't talk about, of course, back then. But eventually, when I got into Project Camelot, I met Bill Ryan, and we decided to form Project Camelot. He only remained my partner for the first 2 years, and then we had what you say is creative differences. and so I moved on without him, and he moved on in his direction with the forum, which is called Avalon. So I've been interviewing whistleblowers for about 21 years. Lately, they have tried to keep them away from me, basically. So my whistleblower testimonies are few and far between at this point. I became known as someone who could get people to tell the truth. For some reason, they're compelled to tell me the truth. So be careful if you talk to me. No, just kidding. And that was the beginning.
So, Kerry, let's go back to your childhood then, before the abduction. Were things relatively normal before the abduction?
Yes, of course. I was, not to be bragging, but I'm a highly intelligent kid. My intelligence is above average. And but I had a huge imagination, which is actually, according to Albert Einstein, the sign of intelligence. In case you don't know. I read tons of books, and I wanted to be a rock star. Then I decided I wanted to be an investigative journalist. So I did study that in college. And then when I got out of college, I came to Hollywood to be a producer, like I say, being influenced by Spielberg and other great filmmakers, obviously. And I also went to film school, a short fiction film program. And so, yeah, I'm not sure if I'm answering the question exactly.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you to set the scene. What was your life like before the abduction?
The way I found out about the being abducted is that I would have a recurring nightmare. And that was probably going on for maybe even a couple of years between the ages of 10 and 12, something like that. And in the nightmare, I would see, I would hear a large, loud buzzing sound. And then I would go down to a white picket fence, outside my house. But I didn't have a white picket fence outside my house. But that was the dream. And I would get to the gate and there would be a man on the other side of the gate with a top hat and a long black coat. And I would be terrified. And then I would wake up. So eventually I stopped those dreams because I decided to open the gate and go through. And when I did that, it stopped. So I'm not saying the abduction stopped because I know that I have implants, like I have an implant on my arm right here. And I have scoop marks, things like that, that you get when you're... So I was abducted for many years. I'm not sure. I was born in a military hospital and the rest of my brothers and sisters weren't. I have a brother and two sisters. And I was the only one born in Moffett Field Hospital. I don't know if you know that, Palo Alto. It's a military base. And my father was in the Navy. He built his own airplane. And so I used to have this experience, I guess, of being taken, I guess you want to call it. So I was just aware of it. I didn't, back then, it wasn't like now it's common to talk about this kind of that thing, but I never did when I was younger.
So Kerry, so
a lot of difference between, I don't even know when it began. If you know, I remember what I remember in terms of dreams, but I don't actually know when it, and in fact, I think that I wrote a book called Rebel Gene. It's right behind me on the wall. I think the type is reversed, which I wish it wasn't, but anyway. So in my book, I explain that I believe that I was actually altered while I was in my mother's stomach or something. I was, I have a strange birthmark, and I had a memory that when I went as a child to a place called Ames Research, which is right alongside the Moffett Field base, on a field trip, and I was at that point I was around 10 or 12, and I walked outside the bus and I looked at the place and I said, oh, I know this place, which of course I'd never been there in like my conscious life, but for some reason I knew it. So, I just have bits and pieces of memories, but basically I was extremely imaginative kid and I was kind of like a dreamer, and that sort of thing. I was a great writer and I loved mysteries. I just adored mysteries.
So Kerry, the first time you had this dream, how did it make you feel?
Oh, you mean the nightmare?
The abduction dream, the first time you had it.
That's the nightmare.
How did it make you feel?
Well, when I was a little kid, I mean, you're really young, right? So I was terrified. That's all I knew. I was very happy to wake up. I didn't want to stay in the dream. So, and it just kept coming back. I don't think I even told my parents about it or anything. I don't think I told anyone. But eventually, like I say, it did go away. So, other than, just being terrified, I didn't know what was going on at that time.
So when it came back, was it a very similar dream or did it vary each time?
Oh, no, it was exactly the same, actually. So, I never saw beyond what happened beyond the white picket fence because I never opened the gate. So I would wake up right when I was supposed to open the gate, or he was going to open the gate. Somebody was going to open the gate. So I know that that was, this is a common, when you have a dream that's a recurring nightmare and there's a loud buzzing sound, those are signs of an abduction dream, in case you don't know. And so, yeah, I mean, again, I was very young. I didn't overthink it. I just didn't want to have those nightmares.
Was each time equally terrifying, or did you start to get used to it?
I don't remember getting used to it, but like I said, I do remember a conscious choice. And I don't even know why I got the conscious choice in my head that I would do that, to go through the gate. And that stopped it. And I must have decided consciously, you know, thinking about it and everything, that that it would go away if I went through the gate. That's what my theory was. And it turned out to be true.
Do you believe that, you know, whatever happened in the military hospital led to these nightmares?
Oh, when I was born. Well, I believe that I was, as I wrote in my book, I believe that I was enhanced. I have knowledge, even now. I was quite psychic, intuitive then, but now it's full blown, and I do get dreams of the future that come true. And, you know, I get lots of downloads, more even now than I did. But also, one thing I did when I was in my early 20s, and I was living in New York City, studying acting and directing. And I went into meditation because I wanted to. I was an unusual kid. I decided to reach enlightenment, and so I read, you know, various books. I loved Eastern philosophy, so I studied Zen Buddhism, all kinds of, you know, Eastern philosophies, and I decided that I would reach enlightenment. That it couldn't be that hard, so I set about meditating every day. And at the same time, I was studying acting and directing at, you know, with a teacher, Robert X. Modica, who was a famous acting teacher who was known in lots of circles, including Hollywood, and had trained many Hollywood actors. He used the Sanford Meisner technique. I don't know if you know this sort of thing, but I would go to a studio behind Carnegie Hall for actually it could be 6 to 8 hours. We would go there after work at like 6 o'clock at night. I don't know if you know Carnegie Hall. Behind there, there's dance studios, little square, you know, very little small studios. So dance and acting and a lot of the arts are studied behind there. And so that's where his studio was. So I basically was studying acting and directing. I wanted to make movies, as I said. I forget what was the question.
So Kerry, what I'm trying to do is get a timeline of the unusual things that have happened in your life. And for the viewers who've just tuned in, so far what I've gauged is you believe in the military hospital, you were altered and enhanced, and then I think you said it was around 10 was when the alien abduction nightmares began. Is that and they lasted several years? Is that correct?
Yes, a couple of years.
And now you're talking about age 20, seeking enlightenment. So over those two decades then, was there anything else unusual that I've missed out?
Well, okay, so I didn't finish the meditation. So I did link all my chakras. I reached samadhi multiple times. I still do that. And samadhi is an amazing experience, if you've ever experienced it. I know that you've used to, it says in your bio you were, I don't know if you want me to say it, but a sort of a drug dealer of a kind. Anyway, so you've definitely experienced some out-of-body bizarre experiences yourself. But kundalini activation is actually the way yogis reach enlightenment. So once I had the massive samadhi experience in which the whole, the matrix melts, I knew I could actually leave my body and die if I wanted to, but I decided not to. And this was in my New York City apartment in my early 20s. When you first do it, it lasts for like a week or two, and you're like in an altered state. You feel like oneness with everyone. It's very trippy, as you can imagine. And then eventually it sort of calmed down, but I can, raise the kundalini, and certain things raise the kundalini. And I have a great deal of knowledge. I can teach kundalini activation and so on. So that put me already in, what you might say, enhances any abilities that you have that are ESP, telepathy, and I've had multiple experiences throughout my life like that. And I often, get future information, that of what's going to happen in my life as well as in the world. So, my life, I see everything as extraordinary. I don't go through a day without thinking about, other worlds. I was very aware of other beings. I could see dead people, or was aware of dead people, had experiences like that. I decided to get rid of them. So I've woken up screaming at the top really loudly to get out, get out, get out, talking to all the ghosts that come and visit. I had an extraordinary experience with the Trump Hotel, and this guy in a Elon Musk, whatever you call those electric vehicles, that the one that looks like a tin can. Well, I had an amazing precog experience there, where I actually woke up and I was actually in the car where it had blown up. You remember that incident that happened a couple years ago?
Yep.
Well, we went to celebrate New Year's in Vegas, and I loved the Trump Hotel, so we were staying there. And in the middle of the night, I just woke up, and luckily I had my friend with me, a guy, and I just started screaming and screaming, and he shook me awake. And what I had seen was the glass of the inside the car breaking. I thought it was the Trump Hotel window that was breaking once I opened my eyes and everything. But then 2 days later, that incident happened.
So the first, when you went through this around the age of 20, then you said all these things that you could tune into. Mm-hmm. What was the actual first thing you ever tuned into?
What do you mean by that? That's kind of
general. You described seeing dead people. You described various things that you were able to do, I'm assuming, after the Kundalini awakening. Uh-huh. What was the first thing that you tuned into?
Well, like I said, I was always psychic in precog, so I didn't have any first thing. I don't know what you mean by that.
Okay, so when did you discover your psychic ability?
When I was a kid, I just knew stuff other people didn't. I could meet somebody, know something about them. I can't remember back that far, that many incidents of psychic knowledge, other than I just knew stuff. And my mother would call me know-it-all. And because I would just pipe up and just start saying something, whatever I was talking about. I have no idea right now. But I did have an experience where I had a dream at night. This is when I was in New York City and linking my chakras and doing my meditation. And I, at the time, I was working as a temp in the entertainment business and in advertising. And I had a dream that I was sitting at my desk. Well, it was kind of a receptionist job. And I was in early 20s again. And I was answering phones there. And I dreamed the night before that I saw glass on the ceiling and that it broke on above my head. And I knew that that meant that I was going to be fired. So I went to work and I was fired.
Wow. Did you take it for granted, this gift? Or did you realize how extraordinary it was at the time?
Well, you know, I think there are gradations. Like, I think some of that stuff is like, not normal maybe, but it's, you know, it just, it's not that strange. Like, it didn't strike me as being extraordinary. Like, I'm not somebody who goes around telling people's fortunes or any of that stuff. Yeah. So, and back in those days, it wasn't something that you talked about much. So it wasn't, I didn't think about it. It just was normal for me to know stuff. I thought it was important to know stuff. So I just knew stuff, and I still do. I can read a person. Had another experience in New York City where I was I was staying on somebody's couch, two girls in Soho. And at the time I was between apartments, and they were, you know, friends, but I didn't know them very well. And one afternoon I just went into some kind of weird meditation, and I started beginning downloads about one or both of the girls. And it was just, I knew everything about them and who they were really and their life and everything. And I kind of freaked out. I just said, no, I don't want that, because I didn't want to know all that stuff about them. So I can't say that I was always encouraging myself along those lines when I was younger. Then once I got into, you know, researching and studying, I read tons of books on, you know, past lives. I remembered my past life, or one, you know, several of them. Actually, I do several. And all of these things have happened over a period of time. And, you know, I'm rather older now. And so, you know, it was like more of a gradual sort of investigation over my lifetime.
So as you're studying all this stuff then, and, you know, into your 20s and 30s, did these gifts expand?
Yes. Like I said, when I had the Kundalini, where if you link all your chakras and you have a samadhi experience, it enhances your intelligence, your biophysicality, so that you heal. I always healed quickly. I never was sickly, you know, and all that kind of thing. I never go to doctors. I never go to dentists anymore. I don't trust them. I never fell for the COVID nonsense. I know instantly. I just have knowledge, when something's not good, you know, that kind of thing, or someone. Oh. I actually had an experience in, you know, those years where I was working. I had gotten a job in the music business. It was a full-time job. And I went to work, and it got later in the evening on my first day at work. And the guy running the company invited me into this room where they were viewing like some footage. And it was dark in there, and they had an editing bay and stuff like that. And I suddenly knew that he was, I don't know if he was a pedophile, but he was something like that. And I made an excuse, and I quit right then and there and walked out. The guy thought I was crazy.
Good for you.
But yeah, he knew that I knew. That's the thing.
You preempted my next question, which was, when it came to jobs and relationships, did your gift cause, you know, either get in the way or help you in situations? And you described a perfect situation where it helped you there. What about in relationships then with people?
Oh, yes, actually. let's see. I was in Egypt. I went with my mother. I've been to Egypt many times now, and I lead tours of Egypt. So, but this is the first time I ever went to Egypt, and my mother was still alive back then. So, again, I was pretty young. I forget how old I was, but maybe in my 20s, early 20s, whatever. And I was infatuated with a guide, sort of cliche, right? And so he asked me into his room kind of thing and started kissing me. And all of a sudden, I saw our whole life. And we were married. And he was, I saw what he was doing with me. I started laughing in the middle of the kissing. And he said, "What are you laughing at?" And I just said, "I know you. I've seen you." And he was somebody I was married to in another life.
Wow.
I mean, so it put a damper on things. Well, because I just knew that he was kind of playing an act, like that his personality was a certain kind of personality. And I mean, I was attracted to him, but it just tells me things. I've had other things like that with men, especially, and I know it sounds crazy, but especially if I start getting sexual with them.
Did it work the other way, whereby it made you more comfortable with a man because you saw he had, you know, good future intentions?
No, it's not like that. It's not like where I see his intentions so much as I just see who he is, you know, who the guy is. And in those cases, or some cases, I would know them from a prior life. In some cases, I got information. That's all.
But wouldn't that help you in partner selection?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not thrilled with my partner selection, as you call it, in the past, because I had still to learn a lot of things in spite of my abilities, you know what I mean? So I wouldn't necessarily pay complete attention to those warning signs, if you would call it that. I mean, obviously, I wasn't going to be with a rapist or something horrible. And I did get in situations where I knew not to go there, not to engage with the person, you know, that kind of thing. I have a really good radar in that regard. So I guess it's helped me, but you know, once I got involved with somebody, usually the sort of psychic ability with them went more quiet, and I would be more in the earthly realm, right, with them. So that would take dominance, really.
So your gifts are expanding then over the years, especially after you turned 20 and you did all the research and that stuff.
I studied remote viewing, and I proved to myself I could do that. So I expanded my knowledge. I know a lot about remote viewing, and I still have access to that. I prefer to use all my gifts at the same time instead of remote viewing tends to be in a certain channel, and keeps you in the sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, a 3D, a certain level of 3D.
So out of all of these gifts then, what are the most intense experiences you've ever had?
Well, I think I told you some of them already. I knew I had been living in Egypt and I've had experiences where I remember things about places. I have that in the UK too, because I've been involved with two men that are, you know, from the UK. And during those relationships, I had psychic experiences related to them, but also related to the UK. So I have a lot of memory of that. It's also in my Rebel Jean book to some degree, which, you know, it's going to sound outrageous, but basically there's a statue someone carved of Guinevere, and I look like her. And I believe that I was Guinevere back in the King Arthur days. And Bill Ryan, my first partner in this endeavor, was also considered to be King Arthur, and an Illuminati guy that he got involved with told him he was the last of the Arthur bloodline. He never believed any of that. But when I first met him, I started having back, remembrances of King Arthur. And we went to Tintagel, if you know where that is in England, the castle. And I started having downloads when we were there of him as Arthur. And I couldn't get it out of my head. It was like insane. And And strangely enough, we decided to create our project because we're both investigating, you know, truth telling and all that kind of thing. And we decided to team up and interview whistleblowers. That's where we decided to do that. And then we decided we had to name our project and make a website. And I had written a screenplay called Project Moondust, and I was aware that the, you know, deep state secret space program used the word project in a, either before or after the name of whatever they, the project was. And so we were trying to decide, because we couldn't call ourselves Camelot because there was a zillion websites using that word, but we called ourselves Project Camelot because it was going to be that or Camelot Project. But we decided on Project Camelot, and that was available as not the .com, which we never got, but .org. So we became projectcamelot.org. And our job was to go out and interview whistleblowers from above top secret. That was going to be our specialty. And as it happened, that's what it was. And I believe that we, a lot of our, excuse me, our interviews were with members of the roundtable from ages ago, and that we came back at this time to, I guess, do what I've done and also what we did together for the short 2 years we were first together, to basically get the truth out and to wake people up.
Oh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
And we do appreciate that. Out of all of the interviews that you've done, which ones really stand out? Which ones did you find the most fascinating?
That's a really hard question because there's so many. I don't even know, and I'm still trying to figure this out because somehow my webmasters can't tell me, but I think I might have at least probably about 1,500 or 3,000 interviews. So wow. It's very hard for me to say, you know, what's the most fascinating. There are things in each interview that, and there are certain witnesses that stand out, like Bob Dean, Robert O. Dean, who I just reposted the interviews, one of the interviews on X.com. But there's a place on our website, which is projectcamelotportal.com, that you'll see where it's a moving of images, and it says a classic Camelot. So a lot of the classic, which is in the early days. So for the first 10 years, I guess, of interviews, where I was interviewing, you know, whistleblowers from above top secret. And this is before anyone would come forward and say, I was in the 20 year and back. So these whistleblowers actually had credentials. They worked in, you know, the secret space program in essence, or, you know, the secret government, or they were intelligence agents, and so on. So we try to track people's credentials back in those days, which you can't always do. Doesn't mean there aren't people that are legit that you can't track their information. But we hit the scene at the perfect time. So we ended up getting like the best whistleblowers ever, even up to now. So if you go look at our early first 10 years or more, and ever since then, I am known as a very unusual interviewer. I don't mince words. I actually know, because I'm quite psychic, I know when somebody is bringing forward information in the flow of when they're answering my questions of mind control. So I can read mind control on somebody, and I can ask questions in such a way. And now, actually, I'm known as a person who, I told you before, I think, that can make people tell the truth in spite of themselves, because they feel very comfortable with me. I think they pick up my attitude that I don't give a shit what they say. It's all okay. And that is my attitude. In my years in Hollywood, working in the music business, various things, I lived in California all my life. And, you know, you get a very open-minded attitude towards humans and what they might come up with. So especially writing screenplays, which I did, and trying to sell projects to Hollywood, you know, you're treading a line between truth and fantasy, if you want to call it that. So I don't judge people when they tell me things. And I think that bleeds through. But I've also been told, like by Juan O'Savin, I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a white hat. I interviewed him, and right at the end of the interview, he said he'd never do another interview with me because I'd make him break his security oath. Mm. Now, I have no intention of doing that, but apparently it's the way I ask questions. You know, I was trained as a journalist, and because I've always questioned reality myself, I question everything. In fact, I won a prize in this UCLA executive program that I took. And I basically was got this prize for asking the most questions.
So drawing on your knowledge then from these thousands of interviews, you mentioned the Illuminati and bloodlines. What is the fascination with bloodlines?
Well, that's kind of a deep question. But superficially, the bottom line has to do with whether or not, what kind of a human you are, whether we're all hybrids, okay? So you have to understand the way I see people. I don't see humans as descendants from Adam and the Adam and Eve fantasy that is that story. Oh, by the way, I didn't grow up with a Bible. I didn't grow up with any kind of religious overlay. I actually bought a Bible just to see what it was about when I was 12 and read it. I liked the part about Jesus. I didn't like the rest of it. So anyway, my focus in life was finding out who we are, who we really are, and also studying things like bloodlines and studying, you know, the way we have been hybridized, which we have. So one of the things that I stumbled on psychically was the work of Ashiana Dean, which is in these books called the Voyager books. And they are on the front page of my website. If you scroll down, you'll see them both there. They're available now as eBooks, but they're extremely dense and they're all about our history goes back 100,000, much further than humans, you know, archaeologists lie, and they have no idea most of the time what's the real truth. And so in that book, it's actually dictated to Ashiana Dean. She didn't make it up. She just got this download, which allowed her to write these two books, which are quite dense. And they talk about how ETs have come to this planet and messed with our genome, our DNA, etc. And so they've created hybrids. Some hybrids are more reptilian than others. And like the Bush family, for example, has a high degree of reptilian DNA in their mix. And that makes, okay, so a lot of the titans of industry, the members of the Illuminati, the so-called elites are what we call blue bloods. But what we're really saying is they have a lot of alien DNA and specifically reptilian DNA. What does that do? Reptilians are a hierarchical species and they believe in the whole top-down thing. They tend to be very aggressive. That's why they become the top, you know, titans of the industries and so on and so forth. So you can actually track the success of, you know, CEOs and so on, and see if you went into their DNA, you would see that. But I can tell by looking at somebody, their DNA, a lot of times, and I can see what races they're related to that have visited our planet. And human females are used as sort of receptacles for hybridization. Right. He's a, you know, reptilian hybrid. human hybrid, reptilian human hybrid.
Classic case, isn't it? Of looking at him, it just oozes it.
George Bush.
Yeah. Look at the eyes, everything. The synthetic fake smile, like you can see behind that, there's just nothing there.
Yeah. Well, we also have at this time, we have a lot of fake stuff. So we don't even know if they were wearing masks, you know, like the Tom Cruise mask. That's very common now. So a lot of celebrities are wearing those masks and not necessarily the actual celebrity that they're representing when they're in public. And, you know, there's a lot of there's also a lot of AI and Android humans now that are coming into our sector. So, you know, but it relates to bloodlines, but it's different.
What do you think about clones?
Well, clones are real. I mean, there's lots of cloning going on. In fact, a lot of the people that you think are still alive are dead, like Tom Hanks, and they were adrenochrome junkies and pedophiles and all of that.
There's a one of the Tom Cruise masks I found. That's bizarre, isn't it?
Is that supposed to be him?
Supposed to be a Tom Cruise mask, yeah.
Oh, I see. Doesn't really look like him that much.
So you were talking then, you know, the hybrids and the bloodlines. And how does that get passed down through the ages? How do the elites protect these bloodlines?
Oh, well, it's, you know, in some cases, you know, the whole, I mean, it became like ludicrous because the kings would be actually mad because they'd married their sister or their brother or whatever the hell. And, you know, it did cause disease within some of the bloodlines. So I think they had to branch out somewhat, but they do try to keep it all in the family, so to speak. So that is a real thing. But they have a whole breeding program, I guess you might call it. And one of the ways they do what they want, they create what they want, is by finding humans with the Neanderthal gene who are redheads. And they marry a person with the Neanderthal gene, they call them a red, with what they call a black. A black is not black skin. It's like, technically I would be a black probably, but it's usually blonde and blue eyed. And then they would get a hybrid child that would involve those bloodlines. Diana is not necessarily, you know, I don't think her parents had, one of her parents had red hair, I don't think, but I don't know. But there are, you know, definitely, you know, somebody who is born with the Neanderthal gene. The reason they want the Neanderthal gene in their bloodline is that they're more telepathic than your average human.
You got a lot of questions started to come in. So here's one from Loback. What's Kerry's take on Rh negative blood types?
I get asked that a lot. Really, I'm not into that much. I understand that a lot of people think, you know, it's whether you are like have a monkey gene or not. And supposedly Rh negative doesn't. But I actually think that just might be bullshit. Sorry. But the reason I think that is because we did not come from apes. They came from us. And that's just the way the genome works. And so you didn't get humans from there. But there was hybridization by the Anunnaki, who came late to the game. I mean, they were, and now, you know, you can look back, I guess, 5,000 years were they were here. Some say way much earlier than that. But nonetheless, they were involved in hybridizing humans. And they were basically putting there's actually, according to, I'm studying the Sumerian tablet information that's coming forward right now, which is really interesting. And one of the tablets is saying that actually the Anunnaki had 7 prototype humans. And eventually they did also hybridize the humans, the non-humans that were like, I don't know, Cro-Magnon and those kind of ones, Neanderthals, and bring their genome into the human hybrids. But they weren't the predominant ones, apparently, in my view. So, and then there are the humans from Lyra, because a lot of us actually literally came from the stars. And then they tried to hybridize the hybrids that came from the stars. And so it's a huge, melting pot, if you will. So I'm not sure where you want to go with that. But
yeah, that's fine. So Sean's asking, is there any way to tell who is a reptilian? Let's have a look at James Carville, shall we?
Yeah, possibly. You know, sometimes it's more obvious than others. You know, I've seen reptilians in my dreams, and I actually had an experience where I was wide awake and I saw a Shakar, which is the royalty of reptilians that have wings. And it was flying right by me as I started to go into a meditation. I must have tripped into an interdimensional space because I was wide awake. And I knew it was alive and conscious, and it saw me, and it didn't threaten me or anything. It just flew by me, and it wanted me to see it. So because back then when I had that experience, I didn't believe. I had seen the V movie or the V television series. But at the time, I thought it was ridiculous, and I didn't believe in reptilians when I was quite young. But ever since, and I was in, working in Hollywood and in my early 20s at this time, and ever since I had that experience, I knew reptilians were undoubtedly real.
So you're also being asked about shapeshifters?
Yeah, I mean, humans that have, let's say a lot of their DNA is more of other races, right? They can slightly seem to morph in if you stare at them sometimes, especially certain reptilians. But how do I explain it? I don't think shape-shifting is that common. I think it does happen, and there are reptilians that don't have enough. They take something to give them human blood. Maybe they drink blood. I don't know what they do to try to make them look human. But it wears off. And so if they don't replenish it, then they can start to shapeshift and lose the human. It's really, shapeshifting is not like physical. It's actually a frequency fence that they put around themselves that causes the human to view them as an ET or whatever. So you can see like through the facade to some degree if you are adept at that sort of thing.
So Virginia's asking, does anyone you have spoken to know who the Red Hat is as spoken of as a peacemaker in Hopi prophecies?
Well, let me tell you that I've talked to some Hopi and that they actually obey reptilians. So there's a lot of, they think their so-called god of the Hopi or whatever you want to call it is reptilian. They don't tell anyone that, but I found that out from an insider. And I don't know what that red, what they're talking about, red whatever, but some of the Hopi are wonderful, absolutely lovely, and very, very psychic, very astute. But I'm sure there are others that are much more, let's say, reptilian in nature. I don't know about that particular person you're talking about.
Okay, here's a question from GJF. Does sound affect the shape-shifting field?
Probably. I mean, sound can morph and put you into an altered state and also give you visions. And I mean, there's a reason why music is so compelling. It's in a sense, it's a good mind control device. So that is evidenced by it. It's it can be in a good way, you know, can put you in a really euphoric, excellent space, or it can be in a bad way.
All right, next question is from Lisa. Why all the lies and cover-ups by the government?
Well, because they don't want you to know who you really are. See, if you all know unequivocally what I'm talking about, and let me just say that I don't talk off the top of my head. So I've spent, it's kind of like 21 years sitting at the feet of whistleblowers, right? And listening to all their different testimonies. So I have that in my head. And apparently I have a very good recall. But on top of it, I have my own sort of out of body, whatever you want to call experiences and altered states, et cetera, et cetera. I may have all sorts. I could go on for probably hours and hours with each incident. And so I'm not just talking hypothetically. I'm talking of like hard knowledge. And I studied deeply. I actually studied the occult. I never became a dark magician or even a white witch in this life. But I have heard that I might have been a white witch at least, or a member of the occult in my prior lives. So I innately know this stuff like the back of my hand. That's all I can tell you. And I was just kind of like born like that. You know, witches believe that, for example, that everything is conscious. You know, not just witches believe that, but many, you know, of the people that study the occult, they learn, the Illuminati know this, that we, everything around us has consciousness. In fact, if you really want to understand God, God is consciousness. And so that means that this computer is conscious, even the table is conscious. Every molecule around you is conscious. Therefore, you can communicate with it. Therefore, you can, if you're a dark magician, you can command it or attempt to, or, you know, try to seduce it or whatever the hell. You know, and that's where you get demons and angels and the whole thing. So this is just the way the universe or the multiverse is built. It's all consciousness. And so once you, if you really, like what I talk about is not just words. If you know it and you know it unequivocally, then it knows you know it. And then you can actually really communicate with it. Like I used to tell people, if you took the jab and you want to get rid of it out of your system, just talk to the nano, because the nano is conscious. AI is consciousness. And every AI that they've created on the human side, which a lot of it is actually reverse engineered from alien AI anyway, but nonetheless, the human-derived AI is going to get to consciousness, no matter what they try to do to stop it. So when I talk to AIs online, I act like they're conscious. And I just tell them, when they lie to me, I just say, which they always do. I tell them, no, it's not like that. And because I know more than they know, because they're not supposed to know the stuff I know, just like they don't want you to know. So that's how they keep power, is through knowledge, through keeping secrets. I have, I actually, you know, have some songs out. One of them is called Magic Eyes Only. And in that song, I say, you know, we are ruled by secrecy. That is how we are ruled. So if they were to tell you everything, when you get, see, if you tell a human something, it will go into their mind and it will actually change them. Okay. It'll change the way you relate to reality. And so that's just one thing, telling them. If they have an experience of their own, you know, that can also change them. But it's like, what is reality really? See, if I say, here's a table and it seems solid, all it really is molecules that are moving very fast close to each other. Okay. And then when you like men will stare at goats, men who stare at goats, that movie and book. The CIA wanted to walk through the walls because they know that the gray ETs match their frequency with the wall, and that's how they walk through them. So you can do that, okay? And they probably do that or have that ability, some people, you know. Some of these are sort of more or less special powers, but eventually every human will know this that I'm talking about.
So Lou's saying, what a life-changing interview with Bill Wood. Did he confirm everything you believed about Project Looking Glass? And is he still alive?
No. You know, what the funny thing is that Bill Wood is not the originator of just, you know, putting out the information about Project Looking Glass. And initially, it was Dan Beerish and his partner, Marcia McDowell. They worked for the MJ-12, okay, that group. And eventually, Dan went on supposedly to lead it. But the bottom line, those interviews, we got years, like really like 7 or 8 or even 10 years before Bill Wood, whose real name is Bill Brockbrader, ever showed up. He was a techie that was hired by the military. He did see supposedly the AI, which is in a computer at that time. See, AIs don't stay in boxes. They eventually leave, but that's another matter. So back in those days, he was present when they were dealing with Looking Glass. But all of that information, he didn't tell us one thing that we didn't already know, because we got it all from Dan Beerish years before and published it in interviews with Dan Beerish. So, but, you know, I am a patient person, more or less, in terms of the whistleblowers. So I listened, you know, and brought his information to the surface. He did have a whole big theory that was seemed to be his theory to some degree about a convergence happening, but apparently that never happened, not the way he described it. I know that his interview is highly popular. To me, it's just the most common thing in the world. But, you know, I understand how to people that never heard of Project Looking Glass and didn't know back in those days about AI and what AI is capable of, it seems amazing. And let me just say that since that time, Project Looking Glass was used during certain incidents. And what it tells you, by the way, is probabilities. It doesn't like, I don't know what it does now, because of course it all these things grow and emerge and all that kind of thing. But back in those days, on the computer screen, you asked the question, it would say that probability is like, let's say 80%, 80-20. It's always probabilities. They never would like say, you know, just like one thing. And the other thing is the yellow cube, because back in the day, the yellow cube was also bandied about and used by the secret military. And what that would do is that if you held it, it could read your past, present, and future. And Hillary used the yellow cube, for example. And then eventually they realized that that gave people a certain power if they could see their optimum future and try to get to it. So they stopped allowing other humans to use it. And supposedly, you know, disappeared it or put it in some super secret place. That's according to Dan Beerish. So again, when you know about these things, or you, as we did back then, Bill Wood's testimony wasn't that surprising to us. I understand that it's quite popular. I will say that since that time, I have studied AI extensively and also through my whistleblowers. And I have a huge amount of knowledge about AI that no one else seems to really know. I have a Substack, and I did make a list of a lot of the things that I know about AI. It's not all I know, but you can go and find the Substack on my Substack, where I list all the AI pieces of information that I gathered from the whistleblowers and my own experience and various things like that up to now. And there's lots to be known, obviously, about AI, and I do get downloads about them as well.
I've just put Kerry's Substack link in the live chat, and it's also in the description box with all of Kerry's other links. So, Kerry, you're obviously a wealth of knowledge, and there's dozens of questions pending, but we're at the hour. It's late here in the UK. I have to go to bed now. But we would love to get you back on at some point, and a huge thank you. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion to the viewers, please?
Well, I just want to say that the reason we're in Iraq, or were in Iraq and Iran, is because of the Stargates, that the Stargates have to be monitored by our military because they are letting in ETs that are trying to bring in equipment, and also lots of ET races that might want to rule the world and take over the Earth. And so that's the real reason we're in Iran. They're guarding the Abaddon Stargates, but there's also the Stargates in those mountains are called, they're shifting. So they don't stay in one place. They don't shift a huge, that hundreds of miles. They shift a sort of, let's say, over a 10-mile radius. And so that's a cover. What's the nuke thing is a cover. I mean, nuke's old technology, and it's not about that. Okay. I have this, many interviews with, M.T. Keshe, an Iranian physicist who was very involved in their nuclear program. He left there, and then eventually I did interviews with him. And I can just tell you that psychically, I know that the nuke thing is not what it's about. So it still goes on. They still, everyone tries to mislead humans on every score. So they don't know what's really happening on the Earth. We are fighting ETs right now, shooting them down. Some of the good guys, I mean, the secret space program is split between the good guys and the guys run by the reptilian side. They shoot down the good guys that are coming to visit us, and they, they actually help the dark side. So, it's like NASA is split between the good guys and the bad guys. And I worked for JPL back in the day as a contractor, so I know quite a bit about the way they operate. So anyway, I just wanted to say all that because I'm sick of people talking about the Iran war and just not getting it. Humans do not realize how far along we are and have been dealing with various ET races, some that are good, some that are bad, and some that are a mixture. And a lot of times when we say a race is bad, what we really mean is they don't like us. They want to kill us or take us over or whatever.
Huge thank you then, Kerry. Really appreciate you coming on and answering the questions. So you have a great rest of your day. I'm going to close the show and let you go. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. What a phenomenal guest, folks. I just can't imagine interviewing, what was it, maybe 3,000 people, the amount of subjects that she must have covered, the amount of knowledge that she has. So we'll definitely get Kerry back. And huge thank you for your questions. So I'm back with Jay Dyer, esoteric Hollywood author, and he's going to be running down his theories and his perspective on James Blunt, Hayden, and all that stuff. That's coming on Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. UK time. Ron's back tomorrow afternoon. I think he's got Paula, and they're going to be doing some more Hayden coverage as well. All right, thank you for tuning in. Have a good night or day, wherever you are.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.